in order to deal with the question of how we should deal with the terrorists, we have to first define our status today. Even what we discussed about expanding, that's true for today. In David HaMelech's time, then David's approach is 100%. We're supposed to expand to the territories that the Torah said, and then we're beyond that. Whatever we need, even for commercial purposes, we're allowed to expand to, if we feel we could win the war. It makes sense. But the Torah allows us, in biblical times, we were allowed to expand, provided we followed the necessary obligations of the Torah to try and approach peacefully, etc. Like the Torah says, there are laws of war that the Torah gives us. And in the times of the Torah, so the times being the way they should, then you have a king, and a king can also rule that there's a situation of danger, and as such, he will implement certain laws, be it on Jews or non-Jews. And the high court could also implement things outside the rules of the Torah. They could give the death penalty to someone who behaves immodestly, because they see that that's the ruling that has to set the tone for this specific time. This is true with the king, this is true with the high court. Today we don't have that. So today we fall into a vacuum where we don't have the leadership, be it Torah or the monarchy that the Torah allows to have certain strengths. We don't have either one of those. So what do we have? We have an army that's, we want to say, is a Jewish army. Well, it is in a Jewish state. But you know what? There are Jews living in the United States. And when you fight a war in the United States army, so you're also protecting Jews. So the army isn't just an army protecting the Jewish people. It's also an army protecting the land of Israel and the huge population of Jews. And it's comprised of primarily Jews. But it's still not the army of David HaMelech. And it still doesn't have the power of the armies that the Torah gives armies that have a Jewish king and the Jews being the way they should in the land of Israel. That's not to say that one shouldn't serve an army, but when we look at the army, we have to recognize that the army does not yet have the status of an army in the time of David and Shlomo in biblical times.
How do we know if we see what happened in 48 and in the Six-Day War? Wasn't it quite amazing?
How do we know what?
Well, I think it's quite a miracle, for what happened then.
The fact that the army has seen miracles and sees miracles every day, on a daily basis, you could look back a year ago, the war in Lebanon, they didn't publicize the miracles that occurred then. But many, 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 many miracles occurred, even during that war. People's lives were saved miraculously. Things, when the submarine was sunk, so there should have been 4 times the amount of casualties. But it just so happens that Shabbat, someone said, I want everyone to come and hear Kiddush. So everyone went to the mess hall to hear Kiddush. He convinced a bunch of people to come hear Kiddush, and because they were in the mess hall hearing Kiddush, they didn't get killed. There was another 40 people that should have been where the missile hit, where the casualties. This is just one example of one of the things that happened. But there are many stories of things that happened during the war in Lebanon, and in every war, we've seen great miracles. But that doesn't prove anything. The fact that a person will have a miracle, when Jonah was contemplating, should I leave Israel and not fulfill God's commandment, or should I go to the city of Nineveh and fulfill the commandment? So he went to the port city of Jaffa, and there was a ship that had been 3 days' journey out of the port, and God sent a miraculous wind and blew it back into the port. So Jonah looked at that and said, wow, that's a miracle. 3 days' journey, the trip suddenly flew back. Must be God agrees that I should leave and not fulfill the prophecy. It's not true. When we had during the period of Shoftim, during the period of Judges, that a person by the name of Micha set up an idol and he started establishing his house as a house of worship for idols. So he was looking for a priest. And Moshe's grandson happened to come by and he needed a job. So he told him, here, you could work in my temple. So this Micha, he thought, wow, this is a sign of God is happy with what I'm doing, my idol worship. God sends me Moshe's grandson, such a Levite, such a special Levi. Of course God approves what I'm doing. It's not so. God didn't approve of the idol worship going on in his house. So when we see things that seem to point that God's approving of something, and even if they are miracles, that's not how we make our decisions. That could affect us to reevaluate. That could cause us to look in a certain direction more closely. But that's not how we make our decisions. A prophet can make his decision if God tells him, I'll make you a miracle, I'll give you a sign. So he can make his decisions that way. But otherwise, we have halacha, and that's the guiding force. That's how we decide. what does the halacha say we should do and what we shouldn't do. As far as the halachas of the state of Israel, that's a complicated question. Rav Waldenberg wrote a book on it many years ago, and many people wrote books, and we try to have answers. We don't have all the answers. We have some of the answers. Coming back to terrorists, so we know that if a Ben Noach does one of the commandments, he transgresses one of the commandments, he's Chayav Misa. But then we have to go into the whole question of what proof do we need in order to know he transgressed, and what court can implement those laws. And that's one angle of how we'd approach a terrorist. There's another angle, and that is the question of does he pose a threat to people. The first angle addresses what he's done in the past. The second angle addresses his position in the present. And all of those have different roles in halacha. His actions in the past will have to define who may implement the ruling, and how much proof will we need. And his actions, his future actions, so there we're going to have more leeway if it can be proven that he is a threat. So we have a rule: ha'bala hargo chashkim hargo. If any person sees that someone else wants to kill him, so then the Torah says kill him first. If someone wants to kill anyone. So, what do you mean? You're saying if a policeman is coming in the middle of the night and he sees a kid pull a gun and he's not sure if it's a toy gun or a real gun, how sure does he have to be before he shoots? I don't know. I don't know where you draw the line. How certain do you have to be that your life is in danger? I don't know. I don't know.
If you know, you need to see if someone's coming to kill you. At this point, otherwise, it seems that
the Gemara discusses depending on where he's located. Meaning, let's say a person sees a terrorist in his backyard, he could shoot him, because we say if he's there, he's put himself in a situation where he's an obvious threat. Meaning, the Torah discusses it in a situation where a person wakes up in the middle of the night. And he hears digging, and he sees someone's dug, and he's trying to enter through his cellar. So you see a person digging, and he's trying to enter your home. He's not only coming to rob; he's coming to rob with the understanding that if you stand up there and say, "Hey, don't take my stuff," I'll kill you. We assume that every thief that tries to enter in the middle of the night is prepared to murder. So you're allowed to kill him first. Now, let's say you know it's your father, so you could be certain your father isn't going to kill you. If a person's father is crazy, so then that's a different question. But we assume that even a father that's coming to steal from his son wouldn't kill him. So that's if you're clear, if you're sure that he won't kill you. But if you have room to doubt, and he's entered your domain, so then you could kill him. But we're not discussing a situation where he entered your domain. We're discussing a situation where he's somewhere else. We don't know. He's driving on the road. But he is a potential threat. So that's a broader discussion.
Assume that the person who's digging in the cellar, digging under the ground, knows the Torah.
We don't need him to know the Torah. What difference does it make?
Okay. No,
and if he knew the Torah, he wouldn't be breaking into your home, right?
Yeah.
Hopefully. All of these things have nuances, because it's part of a general calculation as well. Do we endanger soldiers' lives to go in and take out a terrorist? All of these things, they're general questions which have a lot of details in each situation. Then, if a rabbi is asked, he's going to have to analyze all the details. And often there are political questions which can also affect lives. And politics isn't just a game. Politics is also something that affects life. When Golda Meir called the troops back, and everyone was protesting that the troops were so successful, why'd you stop? And she stepped out and she said, there were a bunch of protesters outside of her house, and she said, "I want you to know that the beginning of the bullets that were used this week were not in our possession in the beginning of the week. We didn't have any bullets. The state of Israel was all out of bullets at the beginning of the week. The United States sent them. The United States told us that they don't want us to win. They don't want us to move forward. So if I'm getting my bullets from them, then I'm a little bit limited in what I can do." So political decisions are also questions of pikuach nefesh. It's all questions of pikuach nefesh, and one has to deal with all the angles, not just one angle.
Is the whole land of Israel our domain? That is to say, a non-Jew cannot own land
a non-Jew could own land in Israel. We're not supposed to sell it. The Torah says keep it in your rule. Even if you have to go to a non-Jewish court on Shabbos, go and ensure that it remains in Jewish hands. But the Torah doesn't say that a non-Jew can't own it. If a non-Jew purchases, he owns the land. Yeah. So I don't know. It's a good question. We do that, and I don't know how
you're
we do that.
This chametz that's in your...
No, we sell it agav karka. We usually sell the chametz together with some land. Right, but we sell the chametz agav the karka. I don't know. I have to look into that. It's a good question. Like, how can we sell him the land? I don't know. We say that you're selling the chametz agav the karka. One of the forms of one of right, but one of the forms of kinyan, one of the forms in which we do the transaction, the Torah says that you can give over objects together with land. Meaning, I could give you a foot by a foot of land, and when we make the transaction over the land, we could agree that together with the land, you're going to get a car and all my dishes and all my linen and whatever it is. Any object can be sold together with a small amount of land. So one of the ways in which we do the transaction with a non-Jew by chametz is we do it with a with. You don't have to, but that's how we do it. We do say it should go together with some land. We try to ensure we do all form. We do certain forms of sale that what?
All we really need to sell is the chametz. Why would we sell said land?
We do it really to ensure that the sale is valid. So we do different forms of sale. We do different things to ensure the transaction takes place. So I don't know what we do about that.
You own like land outside of
Israel. It could be land outside of Israel.
They sell that and then they sell say, along with this, take all the chametz.
Right, that we could do. But I never heard of anyone being careful about that. I don't know why. Maybe because we're... I don't know. I have to check.
When that sale is made, it's on the condition that it will be sold back, no?
Nope. He has the option to sell it back.
Really?
But it's not a condition as far as I know.
He said that one of the rabbis there. He said that he trusted this Arab worker. He'd been working there for 10 years. He wasn't going to do any like the down payment, whatever it was, straight up sale, and he'll buy it back afterwards. In the middle of Pesach, comes in with a huge truck. He said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm here to collect." And he took all the chametz. It wasn't just the really really expensive bottles of wine and everything. Fine, you can live out that. But it's also the appliances and like the people's fans and everything like that. He took all of it. And they never saw him again.
Okay. So it's interesting because, in truth, a lot of the chametz that we sell today, if a guy would want to come and take it, we tell him, okay, let's go to court and prove that it's chametz. Meaning, you sell a non-Jew your chametz on Pesach. You're selling him the chametz that's inside your grandma's chinaware, right? So that chinaware is worth a lot of money. If he's going to come and want to take it on Pesach, you're going to say, prove it. You're not going to let him walk off with it.
Very risky. He said he did that where the person who bought the chametz paid extra money, and Riskin told him to go around like different random homes in the front and say, "I want your whiskey." And every single person gave them their bottle of whiskey. Every single
It's nice, but they could have said, "You could have it, it's yours, after you prove in court. The whiskey is yours, fine, the whiskey is yours." But then I have to see the money at the end. Fine, but when it comes to dishes, or when it comes to a lot of other things that we sell, you have a drink at home. You bought pineapple juice that's not kosher for Passover. So you stuff it in the closet that you're selling the non-Jew, and you say, fine, I'll sell that. You don't have a way of verifying whether it's chametz or not. If a non-Jew is going to come to you on Pesach and say, "I bought that, give it to me," you'll say, "No, prove that it's chametz. I didn't know if it was chametz or not." Most of the stuff that we sell today is stuff that we are uncertain whether it's chametz or not. It's the toothpaste that's not kosher for Pesach. It's all the different... drinks, or if you buy tomato paste, which might have flour in it or not, you have all kinds of foods which you don't know if it has chametz, so you sell it. But if he would really want to come on Pesach and take it, so we'd say, fine, you purchased it, if you could prove that you purchased it.
So the courts are closed on based on
it. So we'll open a court for him. We'll figure out a way. Yeah.
There was the case of whiskey factory. You know, there's something like that. Then something happened during Pesach, but the prices went up for whiskey or something like that. And the holder was a Jew and he sold it. And the man came and said, listen, I want it. I give you the money. I mean, he didn't lose the money, but he didn't have his factory anymore.
It can happen. You want to sell to a guy, you could do it. When we were in Muncie, Rabbi Tendler would sell the chametz to the head of UPS, Mr. Redman.
Yeah.
The guy, yeah, he said, and he'd take one of the wealthy people in the community and tell him, you'll help him out, you'll give him a loan if he doesn't have enough millions to cover, because the whiskey store would sell, and a lot of people would sell through Rabbi Tendler, so it would amount to millions of dollars. So you can't say that's a real sale if you don't have someone there who could afford the millions of dollars. So they'd bring good whiskey, so he'd like to come. Like, they'd give him a good bottle of whiskey at the sale, and they'd give him a few $100 for buying the chametz. Because otherwise, a man like that, why should he take an evening out to come and purchase our chametz? But he'd bring someone who could really afford it. But the rabbis usually up the price. They say, you want to buy the store of whiskey? Okay, so there's $100,000 worth of whiskey in the store. So we'll sell it to you for $150,000. We're not saying it's a good deal, but that's the price we're willing to sell to you for. The idea is that it's a sale, but we don't want to make it too lucrative for him. If he wants to buy it, fine, but we're not going to give it to him at a good price. Usually when we sell the chametz, we try to ensure that it wouldn't be worth his while to keep it. And after Pesach, he knows that we'll buy it back from him for a higher price. Meaning, if we sold him all of the chametz for $3 million, so after Pesach, we tell him we'll buy it back from you for $3 million and $250. You'll make $250 on the deal. So you want to put up the $3 million? Fine, you can have the chametz go around collecting it. You don't want to put it up? So, okay, so you have to pay it. And usually we also make it a package deal. Meaning, if he would want to say, I want that whiskey factory, fine. You have to pay not only for that whiskey factory, for everything else that we made one contract. I don't know in that situation what the person did wrong, that the guy could come in and buy only the whiskey factory. Maybe he brought his own private guy and did it a job at home. That was the result. Yeah.
I don't know if it's the right time, but to hear about Baruch Kuk asking about the Shemitah and
the Heter Mechira.
And what we did today.
So maybe in the class we'll deal with it a little bit. And hopefully in a few weeks we'll have a class on Friday on Shemitah and Heter Mechira. Lots of Eznan. We have to... What?
I can't remember when...